Hey Betty, what's your full name?
My name is Elizabeth Carter Springhill.
Oh, really?
You're going to put that on the transcribing tape? Oh, really?
No, but... When did you get to Kodiak, or Alaska? When did you first come?
Okay, well, do you want to know where I went to school?
Sure.
Okay. I went to grade school through the seventh grade in Midwest Wyoming, where we lived. My father worked for Standard Oil in Indiana. We lived there till I was in seventh grade, and then we moved to Longmont, Colorado. And I went from seventh grade through graduation there. And then I went to the University of Colorado for my freshman year. Decided I wanted to become a teacher and transferred to what was then the Colorado State College of Education at Greeley. It's now called the University of Northern Colorado. And I majored in literature and languages and music, and taught. I got an AB degree from there. And then I taught at home in Crooker, Colorado, where I was born, for 3 years. And then I went to Cheyenne, Wyoming and taught for 3 years. And during that time, I had a chance to come to Kodiak, and I came in 1944 to teach school.
Oh, so you didn't come up with your parents?
No.
You came by yourself?
I came by myself during the war.
Wow.
It was wild.
Wow.
Wild time here. But anyway, I taught, my first class was a combination 6th and 7th grade, 35 students, and then I also taught music out in the hall. And we gave programs, and we had a wonderful time. I've never in my life seen kids that were so willing to learn and love school. They hardly would stay home if they were ill. I never saw kids like it in my life. The school was so important to them. And I was thinking, turn that off a minute because I want to tell you something. But anyway, the result was that, as I say, they were just absolutely wonderful to teach.
And how many kids were in the school system at that time? Do you remember?
Well, there were eight grades, and then the high school was downstairs. And then later on, when we outgrew that, where we pulled in Quonset huts and put them beside the school.
Where was the school looking?
Right up here, across from your grandmother's. This
one here?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't it used to be located like where the Johnson Clinic was? By those apartments, Brown Apartments?
Apartments, that's where it was located. It was on a hill there. And, we had combination grades a lot because we didn't have enough room. And then they had the home ec room was there, that building to the side. They taught home ec in there. And then they had another building over there that they taught shop for the students. But the point was that there was a feeling of respect and love for the school. They really loved that school. And we didn't do a whole lot of social things. When we did, they just enjoyed it thoroughly. And when we gave a program, I had the Rotarians asked me if I would prepare a program for Christmas. So we took the children out in the hall, and we practiced, and we had a Christmas nativity 1 year, and another year, I did it 2 years, and it filled the Orpheum Theater twice. We gave it twice.
Oh, the Orpheum Theater?
The old Orpheum Theater. The old Orpheum Theater.
Oh, that's on the top of the
Orpheum. Yes. No, that was temporary. It was another. It was bigger. It was bigger than this one, I think. And they sang. It was no strain to train them because everybody responded. Everybody wanted to do well. And discipline was just something that we didn't even think about. I just can't believe that the children felt that way about school and education. They did. And you can ask some of them now who were in that class, Nancy Norman Sweeney, and Donna Fitzgerald Jones are two examples, and Carlene Molly. Those people will tell you how they felt about the school. It was just a really, really amazing thing. So that we didn't have all these peripheral things. However, we had no guidance counselors, whatever. Didn't even know. Wouldn't have known what to do with them if we had them. Psychologists were just absolutely by the board. I remember realizing, of course, I had had some brief psychology courses in college. And I remember I had a girl who couldn't read. And I'm sure that now they would have said she was dyslexic. But I didn't know what was wrong with her. But she had a very wise mother. And I called her in and we talked about it. And I said, don't know what's wrong. I have no way of analyzing this. I don't have the tools to do it. But I know there's something wrong. And I would love to see you take her to Seattle and have her evaluated. She did. The girl was found out, they found out that she did have learning problems. She went to a private Catholic school where they tutored her, Forest Ridge Convent. And that woman is a successful adult here now. You know her?
So what about other types of what they call specialists now, like resource?
We didn't know what that was. We did it all.
And
however, there is one thing we did not dwell on, and that was what's happening at home. I didn't know whether their fathers were falling down drunk or whether there was incest or all of these things that we hear about now. If we knew it, we didn't pry, and nobody told us. So what we did was spend the day on what we were supposed to be doing, teaching those kids. And it was, there was something kind of refreshing about it. I don't know exactly how to explain it, because I'm not saying that you don't need all these peripheral, all this assistance that you get now. I'm not saying that. I'm not advocating that you go back to the way we did then. I'm just telling you how it was then.
But right now they are pushing or advocating to go to what they're calling the inclusion model, where all of the kids, no matter if they're learning disabled or autistic or whatever their disability is, that they are in the classroom. What do you feel about that?
Well, I've heard the teachers, I remember when mainstreaming first came into being, and the teachers were horrified by it then, and many of them still are, because in that situation, there are students who are really, really a detriment to the regular classroom, and the other kids have to suffer. That I don't approve of. Don't know the answer. I'm not saying that I know the answer, but I'm just saying that I've heard the teachers talk about it. It was just starting when I retired, and it was becoming a federal law. You had to do it. And we would have been, we wouldn't have known what to do. I remember the first time we put a special ed class here. We were told by the government that we had to. We didn't know what we were doing. We didn't have a room for it. We didn't have a curriculum. We didn't have a teacher. We absolutely were winging it. And it was a strange result.
What did they do before? Did they just not bring them to school? Or?
No, they sat in the classroom.
Oh, but they didn't really expect anything out of them?
Just let them participate as they would. You didn't expect them to. There wasn't even one of us that didn't have at least two in our class that would fit that description. I can name two right now that I had that I simply never embarrassed them in any way. I never caused attention to them. They did what they could. But mostly they remain inconspicuous. And we had large classes, and I'll be frank to tell you that they got very little special attention.
What do you mean by large classes? How many?
35 I had when I first started, and some 36.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon. This is too many.
How many teachers were here at the time when you arrived here?
Well, let's see. First, second, third, they have fourth and fifth combination, they have one, fifth and sixth. I believe the fifth was alone, and then I had the sixth, seventh, then the eighth was alone, and then they had the 4 years of high school downstairs. It's very crude, very, very rural. It was like a small, small town. It was a rural school, so it was.
Well, you said you arrived here during the war,
right?
So what was it like because of the war going on?
Well, for one, I would have had perhaps almost all of my students would have been Native or part Native. There were at least 10 or 15% who had come with their parents for jobs related, civil service jobs or businesses that were coming into the town and so on. That would have been, example would have been Nancy Sweeney. Her father came here to be a pharmacist. So she came, and she, I would say that in that class, she was probably, I bet there were about 10 all white students, and all the rest were Native or part Native.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was the first?
Including your uncle, Raymond, and Uncle Richard. You were in that class. Raymond had to go away because of his illness, and so I didn't have him, but I had Richard.
Do you know if that was kind of like the first influx of Caucasians
in
Cambodia?
Yes, yes. The only other people that had been here before was a very small nucleus of professional people. There were the doctors, maybe two or three doctors, and then there were the people I lived with, the Coons, and they had the Standard Oil, and some of the nurses, and then the cannery people came who just passed through here but who lived in Seattle, and it was just, you're absolutely right, that was probably about the war is what brought the white people here for the jobs and so on.
Yeah, so they had classes together, the whites and the Natives.
Oh, I never even knew the difference.
Yeah, there's some stuff in history that talked about them not having school together.
Oh, indeed they did here.
Was there a bias towards the Natives?
Never. Never. I didn't even know. I didn't even dream of that. I came here from the Rocky Mountain area, which is really quite provincial and bigoted. And it never even occurred to me that these children were different in any way because of race.
They could speak English pretty good?
Pretty well. The only thing was they were very shy, and they talked low. So I thought I was losing my hearing the first year I came here. And I thought I'd lost my eyesight when I went home in the spring because we had 4 drop cord lights with bulbs for lighting. It's weird. And we had, the windows were our ventilation, and sometimes it got pretty ripe in there. As a matter of fact, I had a boy in my class that year that fell asleep every afternoon. And Mary Lynch was the nurse, health nurse for the island, and she came in and I said, Marion, I'm worried about this boy. He's falling asleep every afternoon. Turned out he had a wild active case of TB. She got him out of there. He exposed every single one of us to tuberculosis in that class. I still have scars on my lungs, or I was exposed.
What'd they do back then for TB?
They hauled him out of there, and she went around the town. That was another thing. She didn't get full cooperation because she went around and said he was not to be served, he was not to go to the movies, he was not to be served at the fountains. And his father did take him to a sanitarium where he ran away and came back. He had spontaneous recovery. Suppose there he was, the TB.
Did anybody get it?
Well, I don't know. Your uncle already had it. Your uncle Raymond. And he died. And I brought back with me this time, this isn't relative to this at all, but in my brother's things, I found a letter that I had sent to Iris years and years ago. He because she was 70 Adventist. And your grandmother had received, don't you want to turn this off?
No, if there's any parts that you don't want to,
okay.
Just omit it.
So your grandmother received from the Seward Sanitarium the writings that he had written in longhand, lying in bed. I don't know how he did it. And he sent them home to her, and they sent him home, and I remember he was laid out there in your living room, in her living room. And I went up to see her, and she said, "Rich Raymond wrote these things before he died. I'd really like to have copies." So I must have laboriously typed them off with carbon, because we didn't have copying machines then. We had hectographs that we laid on the jelly and pulled them off. You have ever seen a hectograph?
No.
Well, they're fun. You've never seen a hectograph?
Uh-huh.
Oh, they were fun. But anyway, we didn't have anything like that, so I went ahead and typed with carbon, and I brought the copy home to your mother, where he tells about his revelations about his religion. It's very touching.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it as far as he went, up right up to the time of his death, and then I sent them a copy of this to Iris, because she was such a devout Seventh-day Adventist. This boy tells them how he felt. You should know it in light of the fact that you have become interested in religion. You must read this. Very touching. I found it by accident when I was at Carl's. I was digging through everything. And I found this. Oh, I'm taking this to Hazel.
Yeah.
It was very touching. So anyway, coming back to, you asked me, if we had any active TV, I don't believe so, but we had three strange maladies that year. Here I was, my first year in Alaska, and Raymond Masson got leukemia. We didn't even know what leukemia was. We're in 1944 now, remember. Leukemia was just an exotic word. Just, if you've got it, bye-bye. There's no hope. And he sat there in my class, and he lasted almost a whole year until they finally took him to Portland. And the way that his disease manifested was a huge enlarging of the lymph glands. Really was sad. Another darling little girl, a Grigoryev girl, Lucy Grigoryev was her name, contracted tubercular meningitis. Never heard of it. Wow, she's terrible. Her, I think her mother's still this year. Darling little lady, Lucy Grigoryev, was her grandmother's neighbor as you went in front of the school and down there, the alley to the main street. Lucy Grigoryev had a house there. And this was just a beautiful girl. And my first experience from going into a home where the body is laid out in the living room, they did that. And your grandmother did it with Raymond. They brought them home, and they laid them out in the living room. People came and visited, paid their respects. Pretty fascinating. But then to come back to the education, it was highly centralized. Absolutely fascinating the way they did it. It was the territory, you know, Alaska. Mm-hmm. So we had a very, very strong education department in Juneau. And Dr. Ryan was commissioner, territorial commissioner. And he had a theory that every single school in the territory should be teaching the same thing every hour of the day. So that if you had said on your door, you had to post it on your door, you said, "I'm teaching math from 8 to 9, you better damn well be teaching math from 8 to 9. Because if they happened to make a surprise visit, and they did by steamship and funky planes that they, if they could get hold of them, they would come and they would check you and what you were doing. But we did it automatically because we had this feeling that maybe this was the best way to handle this unwieldy. It was just like a center with all these tentacles spreading out every corner of the state. And so we did. We went ahead and took it very seriously. Beyond that, he wrote a curriculum. And the curriculum said what we should be teaching, the basic subjects and what you taught. And if you didn't teach that within a year, you felt like all was over. I had a terrific compulsion to follow that territorial guide. And if it said that you were supposed to teach so many words in spelling by the end of the year, I taught those words. We really were, we had this strong urge to do just this, whatever is happening, what they told us to do in Juneau. It wasn't fear. It was kind of a security, too, because you knew that if you covered that, you were doing what you had been hired to do. Anything else that you did was just fine, but to really cover that curriculum, I wish I had a copy of it. It was the most amazing thing I ever saw in my life. It's this thick, about 3 inches thick, and he took every single course from first grade, never mind kindergarten in those days, first grade through 12. And if you were teaching sixth grade, you turned to the sixth grade curriculum. Spelling, arithmetic, reading, language, geography, history, was laid out there for you. And you better cover what was in there, or you were cheating those children. That's the way you felt.
And that's the first time that they had a curriculum put together like that? Before that, you just kind of winged it?
I don't know. I came here when that was a reality. And he had been here 2 or 3 years before I came, and he was a strong administrator. And it was really an amazing piece of work to put that curriculum together. And it was not, his name was Dr. A.A. Ryan, I never will forget. And he had some good people in the department, and they'd come and visit and talk once in a while. How often did they get to go to you? You know, how often did they get to know him? But then you never knew when they were coming, and you just took it seriously. I took it very seriously. And I really was so bound by that all through my years of teaching, I was always haunted by the fact that I had so much material to cover, and I better cover that material, or I was cheating those kids. I always felt that up to the time I went into administration.
Who was the principal at that time when you were first teaching?
We had a superintendent principal, his name was Harry Holt. He's a good man. And he was, the teachers were pretty good. I can remember those primary teachers doing a fine job. And I had this feeling, some of the things I did together, fifth and sixth, but most of it I taught them separately. It was just like a wall was between them. But we did music together. And we did some literature together, and when I read stories, I read to all of them. And so it was an interesting time. This, I'm talking 1944 now.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1945, that was the year that I got married. And again, I had a combination grade. And it was a, did I have one grade that year? And then each year we made little adjustments. Maybe we'd get another room someplace. I know some teachers are teaching in a Quonset. I never did teach in a Quonset. But I was heavily art-oriented, and we did timelines in history with the paintings. I still have pictures of it. They were so good. And if they finished their work, then they could go and work on the board on their project or on the floor. And it wasn't, even though the thought was to keep it a quiet classroom, it wasn't so quiet that it was just sterile. There was interaction and movement going mm-hmm. all the time, but there was never any commotion of any kind, ever.
Well, how were the supplies and stuff for teaching?
Very, very sketchy. We had enough books, and we had to be very careful. Our budget was very low, and I don't know how much local support they got. This wasn't even an incorporated city at that time, so it came from this territory, and we had adequate textbooks. That's another thing. They had a centralized textbook supply, so that if you didn't order, if you were dared to order a social studies book that wasn't on the textbook list, you didn't get reimbursed for it. You had to pay for it yourself. thought they were perfectly good. They were carefully chosen. It wasn't a bunch of goofy stuff. Mm-hmm. The social studies books were good, standard material. We had Houghton Mifflin, Scott Forstmann, and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't bad at all. But we didn't have anything extra to learn on it. We were careful, extremely careful. And then as we went on through, it seemed to me it never improved. The whole time that I was connected with the school, we were so frugal that it's just amazing to me now to see the unlimited supply, you know, but most of the unlimited supplies that are, you know, are around, and the freedom you have for choosing textbooks and things like that. So I'm not saying it was better, I'm just saying it was different, and this is the way we coped. And we got the job done.
Now, when did you become a principal?
Well, let me see, in about 1960.
So you taught for about 20 years?
I taught 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and music in that time.
And are there other teachers that you taught with that still live here in Kodiak, or?
They taught for me, Guinan Cessna, Ruth Breckberg, Madeline Holland. Taught for me. And Chet Hagel, and I had Stratman. Those were later years, but there are still teachers here that I taught with, and they were, I really had such a good experience teaching.
Did you like teaching over?
I couldn't choose. I had to. I enjoyed them both tremendously. And one evolved into the other. As the need for an elementary principal grew, and Mr. Schott asked me to do that, I had the job without the credential. But I had to make a decision whether I was going to trot off to the university in my 40s and get a master's degree or not. I elected to do that. And I never regretted it. It was tough at my age to go back to the University
of
Washington. Mm-hmm. And I did it in summers. But I had the job, as I say, before I had the credential. But I had to show good faith that I would go ahead and do it.
How many years were you a principal?
Well, that's what I'm trying to think. I taught a total of 31, 25 of them here. I would think that perhaps half and half, maybe 6 years off that I taught outside, that makes 25 here, 6 and 31, 25, and in that I'd say 12 and a half of each, 12 of each, or 12 and 13, something like that, with just about half.
So you taught regular classroom and then music to all the grades, or just your class?
One year, I did half-time principal and half-time grade school music.
Now, did they go to your classroom, a special classroom for music, or
I
how
went.
Did that work?
I hauled the piano. I had a piano on wheels, and the kids would move it from room to room for me.
They'd actually push it down the hall.
Uh-huh. Don't you remember that?
Yes, I do. I still get it on tape.
Uh-huh. I pushed it down the hall, go in there, and away we go. And oh, I love teaching music. That was such fun. And I had such a good time teaching music that I have I'm very, very resentful of teachers that I think don't put into it what I think should be, because you can destroy the love of music very easily, and that I'm very sensitive about.
I won't put names there if I don't want to do that. So, how did you meet John?
Well, the first year that I was here, I had a wonderful time. dated the boys.
Navy
and,
boys?
Oh, Navy, Army. I never dated a Marine. See, Navy, Army mostly.
And what kind of activities did they have going there? Social type things?
Well, it was pretty limited, but we would ride in buses out to the base and dance and go to parties out there. There was a little more freedom if you went with an officer. You could, they could take you out the officer's stuff, but I preferred to date enlisted men.
So the Army and the Navy were here.
And the Marines and the Seabees. And the Air Force, they're the construction, Navy construction. And the submariners were here. The only ones I dated were Army, Navy,
mostly.
A lot of social life, and I had a wonderful, I don't know, we had lots and lots of fun. I can't even remember, it's like a dream to me now, but I just know it was a lot of fun. And then I went home in May, but my father had died while I was here, and my mother had gone to New Mexico to be with my brother. So I flew home, and they held my job open here, and I said, talk to your mother, Mr. Holt said, and see what we'd like to have you come back, but we understand. So when I got home, I said to her, would you like to go back to Alaska with me, or shall I look for a job here in the States? She said, let's go back to Alaska. He came. And that, on the way back, we went on the steamship Yukon. And John was on that.
Working on the boat or just coming to
Alaska? No, he'd been out to sign the papers for Bob to go into the Navy underage. Bob was 18 and he had to sign Springhill.
Oh. He was
his
son.
Mm-hmm. So then what happened? Oh, and then I got married. And then the next year I had a baby. And I took a year off when she was born. And they were so short of teachers that they said, don't quit, just take a leave. So I did. Then my mother was living with us. And I went back and I taught straight on then, except the year that Mari was to go to kindergarten. They didn't have a kindergarten. So I stayed home with her that year. That was neat. I enjoyed it. And then she went to school, and I went back to school, and we just kept on and until it was a total of 31 years that I taught.
So how old was your mom about when you first brought her here?
She was, my father just died. Was she, about 60. 60 or 61.
And when did John start Dad's Ark?
That was an interesting thing. He,
Were you still teaching?
Taught all the time, yeah. He started that. No, what we did, we bought a store downtown called Dad's Liquor Store. And he enlarged it by half and had his barbershop and jewelry store. And they still had the liquor store on the other side. But that didn't work out well, so we sold the liquor store. And he just kept on with the barbershop and the store. Right up until almost the year before he died. Which was 83. So he was living that a long time.
What did he do when he first got to COVID?
He was working for the contractors out at the base. And then he was doing construction work in town. He worked on Craft Store and the Mecca, some of those bars that were being built. And in the meantime, he was building at night on this place up here that he bought, middle one, which was our first home. And then about the year that, was Mario's about three, I guess, he decided to build the apartment house. So he built that. Then he decided to build the triplex. So he never stopped. He was busy all the time. Right up almost to the end of his life, he never stopped working.
Yeah.
years old, still pounding nails.
Remember that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Up here, worked on this. I.
Were there any other kids, any other nationalities besides just the natives and the white people that were down here?
Oh.
Chinese or
nothing. We didn't have one black child. We had no Oriental. As a matter of fact, we had very few blacks or Orientals. All the whole time I was connected with the school, that happened since 1971. This influx, this interracial influx. And of course, the Canaries, I think.
Now, could the native kids, could their parents speak English also, or is it just pretty much the kids that you could communicate with at school?
No, no, no. They all spoke English. Well, your grandmother. They were just, sure, spoke English. There's no problem with language.
Well, you graduated, you said, with language. Do you mean you spoke other languages?
No, I had a Latin. That was literature and language is what it was called. Did I say languages? It should have been literature and language. That was my major. And I had a Latin minor and a music minor. Never used the Latin minor. And when we were given our certificates here to teach in the territory of Alaska, it was a high secondary. They didn't give elementary certificates, they gave them all secondary, but you could teach any grade.
Hmm.
It was, I don't know why, it was a technicality of some sort. So if you look at my first certificate out there, it's the granted by the territory of Alaska, and it's a secondary certificate. So that was kind of interesting.
What was your favorite grade to teach?
You know, I've often thought about that. I believe 5th and 8th are my favorites.
Why is that?
Well, 5th grade, they're really ready to start learning and doing something, but the skills they've learned, they're reading, they're writing, and so on. So you can do all kinds of stuff in social studies, and I just loved it. Then when I got to teaching 8th grade, I liked that so much, but at that time, a lot of the 8th grade students quit the 8th grade and belonged to work. So I had this terrible compulsion that if I didn't teach it to them, they'd never know it. So I remember doing a unit on Shakespeare, kids, and every single child in that room had to learn the 7 stages of man's speech. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players before they could get their grade. It was a riot. They didn't have to say it in front of the classics, save to me, but they all had to memorize that 7 stages of man speech. It was a riot. And they were just neat. I can't tell you about those kids. They were just... Attitude was the whole name of the game. I know I had one boy who had a little problem in the, and we still laugh about this, Milton Suter, who's a judge over in Anchorage now. We were laughing about this. He said, "Say, Mrs. Springer, you know who I saw on the street the other day? I saw Pupa." I said, "Oh my gosh, Milton. This kid would sit in the back and he wouldn't do anything." And so I said, "Well, this, I'm going to call you Pupa because you're always in the resting stage." You know, in the and they still call him that. And he's these bitch calling Pupa. I don't Milton know about it.
What was it like during the tidal wave, especially for school?
You never in your life saw anything handled any better than the way the school was handled. We closed school for about a week because so many kids were flying out of here on Red Cross planes and it was just bedlam, but they turned the school into a shelter and people could go there and sleep and eat. And Legis LeGrew, who used to run the beachcombers, and his wife cooked up there day after day, hour after hour, and dispensed food in his soup kitchen. And as soon as we got back to school, one of the first things I had to do was to see what had happened to our enrollment. And I had so many kids that had left that I had to make up special withdrawal blanks. Then when they started coming back, I had to put up, make special reentry blanks for them to come back. So we had had this great exodus of students during the 10 days of in the aftermath, you know. And then we had them coming back. And we were all, the teachers were wonderful. And we did have some special help, some people from California who were clever with seismology and that sort of thing, who came and gave us some instructions, told us what to do. And one day at noon, oh, this must have been a week after no, it's longer than that, because it took us at least a week and a half, 2 weeks to get settled back in school to any kind of semblance of order. Teachers were marvelous. And my office was down in the middle of the school. I don't know what's there now, even it's all changed, but I was right here. And there was a terrible aftershock. And it shook the building so hard that I really thought it was all right. And I remember that I ran so fast down the hall, I don't know how I did it, just to assess what was going on. And those teachers, every single teacher had those kids on the floor and doing what they were supposed to do. Marvelous the way the teachers handled it. And the kids trusted the teachers. The only kids that freaked out were in high school. They'd run out of the room, the building, screaming and carrying on. But the little kids followed the instructions. It was wonderful. We have lots of special instructions going out all the time to the parents, to the teachers, many emergency meetings of the teachers where we'd reconnoiter and say, well, this is what we have to do. And it was hazardous going home from the school. The roads were all torn up and muddy and miserable. And when you came down from my office down to the downtown area, there were big trucks afterwards, that reconstruction period running back and forth. I thought sure we'd have kids killed, but so we lucked out. But it was a wild, it could have been an absolutely wild, disastrous time. But those teachers, and then Mr. Schott was a real, real strong influence. He was the superintendent, and we all reacted to his solid, common sense approach to everything. There were no hysteria, nothing. Those kids were wonderful. It just makes me cry when I think of it sometimes. When I flew down those, every single one was on the floor with their teacher. And so I flew down that hall. I couldn't believe it.
So it actually occurred during school?
The aftershocks, which was terrible. It was a terrible jolt. just terrified. Let's see, it was 1964. So what? When were you born?
61.
So you're just little, but let's see, Cecile was in school.
The only thing I remember is running up to her. So it didn't touch the school at all. So you're talking about the school that's actually there now. That mm-hmm. used to be the elementary.
Mm-hmm.
They've
didn't
changed into
the
like the arts and
Mm-hmm. And the elementary school was from the middle of the building that way down was the elementary school.
You said a lot of the kids left. How did they get off the island?
They had Red Cross, Navy, Army and Navy cargo planes that took them. The Red Cross did it, and then the Red Cross brought them back. They had no place to live.
Where'd they take them?
Water or nests. But when they came back, it took about a week or 10 days for people to get their wits collected. See, I could go back into my house. It was the water had come up in the basement, and John had to take the furnace apart and put it together, wash each piece with diesel, and then put it back hand by hand. He couldn't get any help. And I was so busy at the school, and so he was on his own here to try to salvage the stuff out of the shop. There were 3.5 feet of water in the store. We had to pick that stuff up by hand, clean it.
How long did it get to how long did it take to get the sewer and everything running again in the town?
I think the sewer was all right, and we had water. It was electricity that was tough. And that knocked your heat out, see. So it was several days before we had electricity, and that was fun. That was another reason people left. They had nothing, you know, they had nothing in their houses. But the rest of us, we used lanterns and whatever we could get. But KEA did a good job, and they finally got us back online, and as soon as we had heat, well, then we began drying out. Everything had gotten kind of dank and bad, and we started then picking all of our stuff together, and when you did, my house wasn't damaged. It was cold and clammy. It was awful. It was very cold during that period.
Is that when they built a lot of these buildings that were supposed to be kind of temporary and they've become permanent? Like the Orpheum Theater and...
No, that, the one that's there now, well, that was urban renewal and it was approved.
Oh.
Those metal buildings were approved, and the one over here, the ones that they put up temporarily were like Dad's Ark, the one here, and then the little Orpheum Theater that they moved out, that was the temporary structure. Mm. And they had a temporary Mecca, and they had ways of kind of getting around it. But it was a terrible time. It was a dirty, sloppy, messy, muddy time. I don't know why I can remember the mud so bad. It was just awful. Streets were just... Behind the school, a boat called the Salif was grounded up there. Full crab. Well, that crab brought it. Oh boy. But the way they got it down the hill was like the time of the pyramids. They put rollers under it. And they rolled it down. Oh, I wonder if anybody has movies of that. It's so priceless. It was really a feat. They rolled it down on logs. And then when they got it down to the street, they rearranged the logs and they just go like this, you know. A little, it was amazing. I remember my eyes were just bugging out. I never saw anything like it.
Fishing industry like this whole time that you've been here from 1940.
Amazing.
You know.
It was absolutely amazing. When I came here, the biggest acts in town were out around the island, the Kadiak Fisheries, and that was a growing concern in the summer, and it was really big, that part of it. Then nothing happened in the winter. And you had several fishing families, the Olsen family and Torgut Olsen, and then there was another Nelson family. Your mother knew the Nelson girls. And those families fished all summer, and they made a good living, and they had nice houses, and they, you know, they were just comfortably prosperous. This went on for many years until, they began to get a little bigger boats and a little bigger operation, but nothing very spectacular. Came the tidal wave, and they got, 3% money. One of the first was Oscar Dyson's boat, the Peggy Joe. That was a huge boat to us then. We couldn't believe the size of it. And it also was, he got it with 3% money. And a lot of people came. The Sudams came, the Heiners came from Saldovia and Cordova and Seward and those places. And they started getting these big boats through the government. And I know the Heiners did, the Sudam, all of those people got their boats through that 3% disaster money. And they started then going after king crab wildly. And also then the shrimp was very good. And some people got very rich with shrimp till they overfished that.
So the money wasn't just for people on Kodiak. It was for anybody that wanted it.
Anybody that wanted to get it. Yeah. Particularly if you had lost a boat.
So was there a drastic increase in kids in school?
Yes.
That happened?
Oh, absolutely. All of these things affected the population people began to come, and there were more opportunities because fishing at that time was a viable industry. And it went, that post-earthquake crab, it was starting before that, but those people would have had to, you know, how would they have ever gotten a boat that went from a 45-foot boat to a 300-foot boat or whatever, I don't, if it hadn't been for some artificial shot in the arm, and that's what the government did. And people took advantage of it, and they did very well, got very rich. And I'm glad, it was a wonderful thing. But yes, the school was definitely affected, because then they needed more fish and wildlife people, and more, you know, protection people. The banking, we got more banks as the money came. Money brings all these things, that, you know, the accompanying industry. And that's why we're feeling it now, because as the fishing goes down, we're going to crunch.
Did they expand the school at the time?
Oh my. We had already built the main school, and the high school was at that end. Then what was the next school that they built?
Junior high, was it there?
East was next.
And that was kind of a, was that supposed to be a temporary thing with the way they had the walls in all the classrooms?
No.
They were like those,
it, were they?
Closed.
Well, what happened was that they got the philosophy of teaching, built the building around it, and the teachers hated it. So they tried it for about 2 years, and they, boy, went back, those petitions went back up so fast, make your head swim.
Mm-hmm.
They hated it. Couldn't do it. They
what
weren't prepared
the
for it.
Hmm? What was the idea? All
open.
The classes open?
Mm-hmm. Open classrooms.
The noise
would
have been
phenomenal. Well, teachers didn't know how to handle it. They were crazy with it. And they never, they just fought it continuously. Never was successful. But that was the mistake of building a building that has to, if we had the luxury of having, picking teachers who really wanted to do it and the children who really wanted to do it, we can't do that here. We've got to, you've got to serve the area. It's a geographical arrangement more than an educational arrangement that we have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it's been my contention, and I have never seen it, it never has worked successfully for an administrative device to be imposed on the teachers. Won't work. Fight it to the death. And they did. They fought it to the death. Boy, I tell you, those petitions went up in a hurry.
I remember going to school out there.
And there were a lot of things also that the teachers, it was a quiet, a noise power problem with the gym right in the center. It wasn't the best plan in the world, and they had a lot of gripe about that school. Then they went back to the more traditional thing with the main school here. Then when they did the middle school over again, that's pretty traditional too.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any exotic arrangements of walls there. Peterson was always very traditional. But I thought quite adequate. I remember when Peterson was built, and we went out there for their open house to visit it, and I thought, there's no reason why you can't teach in this building successfully. There was nothing fancy about it.
Well,
nothing.
Was that at the time a Navy school, or did that come about just for the Coast Guard?
It was an on-base school.
And what was
Navy.
It like here in Kodiak when the Navy moved out and then the Coast Guard moved in?
Well, that was kind of a shock. But the school never lost population, as I remember. The transition must have been fairly fast, because when the Navy moved out and the Navy families left, it seems as though that school never lost population. It'd be interesting to see what the fluctuation was from year to year during those years of change. But I don't think it was much.
Why did the Navy leave?
They no longer needed this for a supply base to the westward as the war was, because of the war being over. Just like now they're making changes because of the Cold War being over. Well, we made changes then at the end of the of World War II, and they, I just don't remember that Peterson was ever, well, that's interesting too. It was an on-base school, and they had an on-base superintendent, an on-base supervisor who came around, and they were hired by the state and the service some way. I've forgotten how they got their pay. However, they were different. Then the borough took over Peterson. Do you have any idea what year? We became a borough in the 60s, an organized borough, 65. So about that time, they took over the school, and it's now a borough school, just like all the schools around the island. And it no longer has any, the only, I don't even know whether the Navy or the Coast Guard contributes anything to them, except maybe some maintenance and that sort of thing. But as far as the money, that school is funded by the borough. It's a borough school.
How about the village schools now? When you first got here, did they always have village schools? Or
they did. They were territorial schools. They were run by the territory. And then after we became a state, they became state-operated schools. They were operated from Juneau. And the teachers, some of them were paid by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and some of them by the state of Alaska. And it was a big decision to make. When we were forced to become a borough, some of us who were involved in any kind of suggestion said, don't make the whole island a borough. We can't take care of those village schools. It'll break us. Just make it the road system. They said, you take it all, or we'll even include something along the mainland. You know, cheating for something. So we were blackmailed into making this the borough. We then had the schools. However, if I remember right, the state did help with the funding. I don't think they just said, here, they're yours, fund them. It seems to me there was a gradual transition there so that it softened the blow a little bit of being responsible for those seven villages. That was rough.
Yeah. Were you a principal at the time or teaching?
I was on the borough assembly too. It was a strange time because we didn't know what we were going to do. We didn't know how we were going to have the tax bases in town. The villages haven't a tax base. The Indian, the villages don't have, the natives don't pay taxes. We paid the taxes here in town. So that meant that just this small group of people were going to be responsible for the entire island. Some people said, foul ball, we can't do this. However, I don't know exactly what the extent of the state support was, but they've come through, I think, fairly well. When we first became a state, I was interested in how they were going to set up the school board, the state school board. And at the time, I was afraid, and a lot of us were, that if that became a political thing, so that the Commissioner of Education and the State School Board were at the whim of the governor, that would be hazardous. So we fought for what they called, I believe, a Section 7 school board. I've forgotten now what the number was. And it was so that the school, State School Board and Commissioner have an autonomy so that they aren't at the whim of the governor. And it's worked out pretty well, I think, because you don't have as much commotion in the Department of Education as you have in all the other departments. But a lot of people thought that. They said, no, we wrote our constitution so that we would have a very, very strong executive department, and you're going against, you're violating the intent of it. But we stuck to it, a whole lot of us. The teachers fought for that in those days. That was when they first adopted the Constitution.
Now, did they always have a school board when you got here? Or was that something that came?
They sure did. They did when we were territory. Had a territorial school board. Or whatever they call the local school board. They had a local Kodiak school board.
Did they have a police department here?
They did.
Judges and everything?
Yeah. They had a police department and they had a city council. Very. There wasn't a whole lot to be done by it. And Edna Kraft, who's now over 100 years old, was one of the first women on was on one of those first city councils. Isn't that interesting?
I just saw her this summer.
You did?
Yeah, during her birthday. Mary Reed and her mom and everybody came for her birthday and they had a big cake. And
was she mad?
No, she was sitting up in a, I think she was in a wheelchair, you know.
She was on one of those first, that was before we were incorporated city. What did they call it? They didn't call it the village of Kodiak. I don't know if it was called the city, but...
Well, it was a fort first, Fort Kodiak. And the army came in and built the fort here, I guess. And then when they decided that the Indians weren't going to attack them, they pulled all the army out.
That's funny. Oh, I've got a section in there about the history of the schools in Alaska. It's fascinating. It was fascinating reading for me when I did the research. But they, you know, Sheldon Jackson School, that's fun. I remember that section on Kodiak here, the early Kodiak years. See, I concentrated on the 10 years before statehood.
Did you get her birth date and stuff? When were you born?
May 28th, 1916.
And what
Cripple Creek, Colorado.
Cripple Creek?
Uh-huh. My father was a gold miner.
Really?
But he never came to Alaska.
No, he was planning to come. And then he died the first year I was here in 1944.
Did your mom work?
Never. She was just a mom. Perfect mom. Right? You don't remember as much, do you? It was Boo that, and Hazel that were so close to her.
I remember when you guys lived over there, though. What was your mom and your dad's name?
My mother's name was Augusta. And my father was Floyd. I have one brother, Carl. Small family.
What was your mother's name?
Beeler, B-O-E-H-L-E-R. Her name is Augusta Julia Beeler. Her parents were both German.
And she lived in 92?
93. Mm-hmm. You were the one she died, remember? Oh my.
Did they have school buses? Or was it such a small
school? School buses didn't start until there was nobody living out there in Menasha area. No houses.